There's no other Sunday in the church year that is like this Sunday. It's a schizophrenic Sunday, literally it is. One minute we're shouting Hosanna as we have the kids processing with the palms and Rudy representing the Christ. And the next thing, within 5 days, we're crying Crucify. How do you move from one extreme to the other in such a short time? How do you go from adoration to hatred that quickly? So let me paint for you the scene that's going on in Jerusalem. So you're in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, and this is the biggest, grandest holiday of the year, man. This is Passover. Millions of people are flocking into Jerusalem, just like they do when you see people flocking to Mecca, but this is coming to Jerusalem this time. And you're told over and over in the liturgy for thousands of years that the time is ripe because God took a slave people out of Egypt in bondage to a superpower and utterly destroyed the world's largest standing army at a place called the Red Sea. And you know the story. Your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your parents have passed this story on to you. You've heard it your whole entire life. Your parents have heard it their entire lives. You don't know anybody at all in the entire family lineage, much less your next-door neighbors, who don't know this story by heart. So when you come to remember this mighty military victory that occurred with God, and you've heard of this miracle worker who's out healing people, raising people from the dead, restoring sight to the blind, literally walking on water and turning water into the greatest wine available, you believe that God is about to do to Rome what God once did to Egypt. So here you are, along the parade route, for the conquering hero who's coming into the city, and you've heard so much about this guy. He's a rock star in his own right. Anybody who can draw 10,000 people to a hillside in Galilee just to listen to him talk, that's big time. And of course, there's all kind of vendors, and they're passing out palm branches to everybody so that they can wave as a sign of homage to this conquering king that's coming into the city. Some of the folks are even laying down their garments, their coats, their tunics, but you've had yours dry cleaned, so you're not gonna wave that and throw that down. Instead, you just go on with the palms. But the atmosphere, you see, is charged with anticipation. It's charged with anticipation and celebration. After all, he might just be as big, if not bigger, than King David, who you knew slew the giant of all giants, Goliath. He's probably going to be bigger than David. So we might excuse these folks for failing to notice one significant detail. This Messiah comes into the city on a donkey, not on a stallion. At first, you pretend not to notice. You say things like this to yourself, huh? Maybe they just were out of horses and they'd all been taken already. After all, it's the biggest celebration in this country and you're in the capital city. Makes some sense. I guess the Messiah's advance men forgot to book the horse far enough in advance. The only problem is the Messiah didn't ask for a horse. He asked for a donkey. But then you would not have known that because you weren't there when he was talking to the 12. How could you have known that? The only problem is that whenever a conquering hero or king would arrive in a city, he always rode on that stallion. Always. You know that. You've seen it happen time and again with people who've conquered your land coming in. It's a sign of power and military might, but this conquering hero, that you've heard so much about is riding on a donkey. And you know that whenever a conquering hero comes into a city riding on a donkey, it means one thing, really. It means he's coming in peace. This conquering king is coming in peace. But he's also sending a signal to you and to Rome. He's saying, in fact, that his kingdom is not of this world. And he's not going to do unto Rome as Rome had been doing unto you. And this is where it all turns. This is where the whole day just turns. The moment that you realize that this Messiah isn't going to do what you expect him to do, you get mad. It's a natural reaction. Be disappointed by your leaders. How dare he mislead us? How dare he let us down? He shouldn't have come at Passover. I mean, it's the biggest freaking holiday in the world for us. He could have come at another time if he was coming in peace. And you know what? You're right. He could have come at another time. He could have come at Yom Kippur or Passover. Passover another time. You've been taught your whole life that the Messiah is going to come as a mighty conquering king. You've been taught this for over 1,000 years, like David or like Moses. So where does this guy get off dissing literally 2,000 years of expectations? It's not like you're the only one who's thought of this. Who does he think he is? And that's the rub, isn't it? That's the rub. He doesn't fit our expectations. We always want to put Jesus into a category that makes sense for us, I think. It's natural as human beings. But he never allows himself to be boxed in, does he? Even when he's being questioned by Pilate, who literally has the ultimate authority to assign him to death or to life, he won't answer a single question. He just remains silent. You see, what we want in life, and I think it's normal, is we want life to be fair. We want life to be a level playing field for everybody. We know, in essence, that it's not, but we want that. And we also want a little payback for the way Rome has been treating us. You know, I'm tired that I've been living near the poverty level, you say to yourself, because of taxes. All the taxes they take from us. I can never get ahead. I can never get out of debt. My family's never going to get out of debt. We're indentured servants. We're economic servants. Slaves, actually. Because they just keep taking more and more and more. They've crucified or terrorized somebody you know. It's been along the way, all the way to Rome. Crosses lining the Appian Way so that people do not forget who is in charge. They've come in and they've totally desecrated your temple, the holiest shrine you know, more than once. It's like coming in here and setting this place on fire just because you can. You have that power. Or the churches that were burned down south. Right? Because you can. You have that power. When all the profound words have been said about Holy Week, what's it really all about? Am I to identify with the crowd on Palm Sunday one moment cheering the arrival of Jesus, but just 5 days later wanting him to be gone because he's disappointed me, he's not going to do what I want, so let's get Barabbas. Barabbas is a zealot, man. Barabbas has been fighting Rome. He's an insurrectionist. He's one of us. At least he's trying to make things right. Well, in his book, Provocation, Soren Kierkegaard, one of my favorite theologians and existentialists, wrote this about being a disciple of Jesus. And he wrote it over 100 and some years ago, and I think it hits the nail right on the head. He said, it's well known that Christ consistently used the expression disciple everywhere he went. He never asked for admirers. He never asked for worshipers. He never once said, you must worship me, ever. No, he calls us to be disciples. Christ claimed to be the way, the truth, and the life. His whole life on this earth was destined solely to make disciples and to make admirers impossible. Christ came into the world with the purpose of saving the entire planet, not on instructing it, on saving, on redeeming it. And at the same time, as implied in his earthly ministry, Kierkegaard continues, his work was a saving work. He came literally and fed people who were hungry. He literally healed them of their infirmities, like the woman bent over or the man born blind. He came to set a pattern of conduct, to leave footprints for people who would follow after him. This is how to be as a human being. This is how to be my disciple. What, then, is the difference between an admirer and a disciple? A disciple is one who strives to be what he or she admires. They want to be that. I want to be like Mike. Remember the slogan, be like Mike? An admirer, however, keeps themselves personally detached from what they admire. I'll think about it. I'll look at it. I'll take the best of what's being said and leave the rest. An admirer fails to see that what is admired also lays a claim upon you, and thus fails to be or strive to be what they admire. Richard Rohr, a Roman Catholic theologian, puts it this way today. Christianity, he says, is a lifestyle, a way of being in the world that is simple, non-violent, shared, and loving. However, we have made it into an established religion, and all that goes with that, and avoided the lifestyle change itself. One can be for war, one can be greedy, one can be a racist, one can be selfish and narcissistic and vain in most of all Christian history since the 4th century, folks, and still believe that Jesus is one's personal Lord and Savior. My words now, like a cosmic concierge, there to do whatever I ask. The world, Richard Rohr goes on, has no time for such silliness anymore. The suffering on earth is too great. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. We all struggle with this, folks, if we're honest. I know that there are times when I'm no different from the crowd that gathered to cheer Jesus and a week later called for his crucifixion, because there are times when I have condemned and judged people who have let me down. How dare you let me down? Don't you know I'm right? I know that there are times when I run away from things that scare me too, just like Peter did. Just like the disciples, all of them, because it's more important to save my hide and to be liked than to honestly take a stand for what I believe to be true and suffer the consequences for it. Kind of like Augustine, when he said, "Lord, please make me a Christian, just not yet." But as I age, thank God, I find I have more questions now. Fewer firm answers, more questions, and more wonder and awe. I'm less interested in intellectual answers or theories, and more interested in this new life and transformation that has been promised to you and me by the one that we call Messiah. But the only way to know that is to follow his lead, his way, his life, his truth.